Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and today we start on college campuses. Families across the Commonwealth are frantically meeting. They're meeting for college application deadlines. They're applying for scholarships, for loans, for grants, and they're filling out the federal financial aid form called FAFSA. Now, college is expensive, and it's getting more so. And this year, a group of college faculty and students teamed up across the state to look at one reason why, and that is the debt that campuses themselves take on. Universities borrow to build, to expand, and improve. And if you're headed to college next fall, some of that debt repayment will wind up in your student fees. Richard Levy is Salem State University Professor Emeritus and co-author of the Campus Debt Reveal Report. And Gayathri Raja is a junior at the University of Massachusetts Lowell and helped coordinate the campus debt research effort across the state. Rich, thanks for being here in Studio 2.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
And Gayathri, welcome.
Thank you.
Great to have you. So, Rich, you estimate that campus debt fees increase student loan debt by about 25%. Is that right?
Correct. Generally, it increases student loans by 25%. On the average, a student in Massachusetts public education pays $2,500 per year just for campus debt.
So pays in their fees, on average, according to your calculations.
Correct.
$2,500 of the fees they pay to the university is really servicing a public college or university's debt, according
Correct.
To your calculations.
And that's a bimodal thing. In other words, students in the dorms pay a lot more than that average. Students at home pay, not living in the dorms, pay considerably less than that average.
So then what you're saying as well, Rich, if I understand it, is that those fees are broken up for students. Some go into the sort of standard tuition and fees bucket, right, which might be for a public college or university around $16,000, $17,000 this year, and some of it goes into a bucket that's room and board and that kind of thing, fees that are associated
Correct.
With living expenses. All right, so let me bring Gayathri in here. When you saw, when the report concluded with those numbers, as a student, did that surprise you? Did you think, yeah, no, that tracks? How did you react as a student?
I would say as a student, I was very surprised. Before this project, I was under the impression that my tuition went towards like books and curriculums and teachers, and that my dorm fees went towards like the building maintenance. I really had no clue that campuses were in so much debt and that my money was going straight towards that. And especially seeing the proportions after our debt reveal, that was incredibly surprising and concerning.
So, Rich, why did you decide to do this project?
We decided because when COVID hit at Salem State, we were told that we had a massive deficit and we were facing 5 weeks of furloughs for everybody on campus, a loss of 25% of our adjunct faculty, and we wanted to look into that and see what was the cause. And we found the biggest deficit we had was our debt service, which is 10% of our budget. And if that were addressed, that would resolve most of these other conflicts. It wasn't excessive faculty, it wasn't excessive service personnel, but it was debt. And what's happening is students are paying in. That debt then gets paid out through bonds to investors and to Wall Street firms that manage this. So the students are both paying first for their own loans, and then they're paying for the campus loans. And what this amounts to is, in fact, a tax on students. It's a tax that's called tuition and fees. So while up until the Fair Share Amendment, the tax system and the tax cuts have been preferential to those at the upper end, it's not that the tax costs have disappeared. They've been transferred down to students.
Okay, so there's a whole bunch in that. And I just want to note, we're talking with Rich Levy, who is a professor emeritus at Salem State University, and Gayathri Raja, who is a UMass Lowell junior, about a campus debt reveal report that looked at the extent to which campus borrowing, especially in public universities and colleges, leads to increased debt for students who are paying off the college debt. So a couple of things. First, you mentioned the Fair Share Amendment. That was question one in the ballot measures, which allows for a 4% additional levy for people who earn over $1 million in a given year, directed towards education and transportation. So that's the first thing. The second thing is you're hinting at something here, and Gayathri, I'll bring you in on this as well. That is the reduction in funding that the state has provided to public colleges and universities. Was that something that came up in the report, Gayathri?
Yeah, so that was something that we definitely looked at. The amount that funding has changed over the years and how that placed the burden on colleges to finance their own buildings and maintenance work and things like that, and how that in turn increased the campus debt exponentially.
So, and I want to read a statement that we received from John Keenan, who is president of Salem State, where you're an emeritus, Rich. Also the chair of the Massachusetts Council of Presidents. The Massachusetts Council of Presidents agrees with the need for greater investment in public higher education in the Commonwealth, and we are advocating for it. The Campus Debt Reveal does a deep dive into one piece of the larger financial picture on our campuses, and it has contributed to conversations about our shared goal of continuing to offer high-quality, affordable education to the regions we serve, end quote. So, Rich, I'll turn back to you here for just a moment. You got to borrow to build. So is your problem that campuses borrow at all, or the way that the debt's getting repaid?
The problem is historically, the state would fund a much higher proportion, if not all, of the construction. And since the 60s, as state funding for public higher ed has declined, first dormitories became the individual responsibility of campuses, and now academic buildings as well. So it's the fact that cutbacks in funding, as you mentioned, have led to shortages, which that's the cause of the borrowing. And then there are two ways to borrow. You can borrow through general obligation bonds, which is the state is borrowing and everybody in the state is contributing to that as a public good.
Because we're all in it together.
Right. Or you can borrow by revenue bonds, in which case the revenue from the students, not from the state as a whole, is what pays back the bonds. And in those bonds, the Mass State College Building Authority for the state colleges sets the dorm rates. The college does not, and they are set to guarantee adequate payment. If there is not adequate payment, the bondholders are able to intercept the state appropriation. They get first call on the state appropriation before it's used.
They get first dibs on the money.
Before it's used for educational purposes.
All right. So in our last 30 seconds or so, Gayathri, now that this report's out there, what do you hope it will accomplish? 30 seconds.
I'm hoping that it'll bring awareness to the issue overall, and that colleges will try to find, that states will try to fund higher proportions of higher education buildings. I also hope that students bring more attention to the issue, faculty are more attuned to what's happening here, and just that the campus debt as a whole is not something that's ignored and pushed under the rug, because I think that if people were aware of the issue, a lot more change would be happening and a lot more would be done to address it.
All right. Gayathri Raja is UMass Lowell Jr. and part of the Campus Debt Reveal State Coordination Team. Rich Levy is a Salem State University professor emeritus and one of the co-authors on the report. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's college application time and scholarship application time and financial aid application time. You get the point. We have had a conversation on the show today about one factor driving the affordability or lack thereof of college tuition and fees for students. It is the debt that campuses themselves take on. They borrow, and to some extent, students pay, especially in public institutions where the state itself is paying less and less. Now, earlier we spoke with two of the authors and coordinators of the Campus Debt Reveal report that came out earlier this year. The report found that on average, students at Massachusetts State's colleges and universities pay over $2,500 in annual fees for their university's building debt. Now, joining us to react to that report, Dale Hamill. He is the Executive Vice President of the Division of Administration, Finance, and Information Technology at Framingham State University, has spent a good deal of his career in university finance. Dale, thanks for being here in Studio 2.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
So the Campus Debt Reveal Project raised significant concerns about students paying for borrowing that public universities do. In a nutshell, is it right that universities borrow and students pay?
We certainly support the conversation about funding for public higher education and its impact on student costs. We see the use of debt as a tool, as one mechanism to provide the programs and services that our students are looking for and demand. It is accurate over time that funding has decreased specifically for some certain capital projects. In the most recent years, we've seen more funding coming to the colleges for capital adaptation and renewal, basically deferred maintenance.
Right.
But in terms of debt, we have a policy where 25% of academic facilities has required campus contribution.
Okay, so let's break this down in a way that somebody who for whom finance is not a part of their language will sort of get and embrace this, because I imagine there are some parents and young people listening right now who are like, well, wait a minute, what is this going to mean for me on campus next year, right? So first, part of what you're saying is a capital project is I'm going to build a building or some piece of infrastructure that's going to stick around for a while. And you're saying it's pretty normal, pretty standard for a big organization, whether it's a college or university or elsewhere, to borrow money to do that versus paying it all up front out of the cash they have. Am I understanding that correctly?
Either the cash they have or total funding from the Commonwealth in the case of a public university.
Okay.
Yes.
So that's the second piece. And Rich Levy, who was the professor who co-authored the report, said to us in the previous part of this conversation, the state is paying less, and therefore the cost of paying for buildings and maintenance and that kind of thing is moving to students. I felt like I heard two things from you in your first answer, that they're sort of paying less, but lately it's gotten better, but not enough better. I mean, can you clarify that in basic ways for
me? Yeah, maybe illustration is good. We recently built an $85 million science building.
At Framingham State.
At Framingham State. $65 million came from an authorization from the Commonwealth. So he was talking about general funds. Those are paid off from the general funds of the Commonwealth.
So the Commonwealth said, we're going to cover $65 million of this $85 million.
Yeah, we received an additional $6 million from other state agencies, predominantly Mass Life Sciences.
So $71 million, at least 14.
Correct.
Okay.
We borrowed against that, and in fact, students pay over time because it's a 25-year debt issuance. So students are, in fact, paying for it. And the argument there is it's both a public good and a private good. You know, what we're getting out of it is a new science, state-of-the-art science facility that is benefiting the students. Part of that cost coverage is coming from students for that addition, and the majority of it is coming from the Commonwealth. Obviously, we would like to see more coming from the Commonwealth because it directly relates to the impact on student fees.
So to be really clear, on a $14 million borrow for an $85 million building, students are going to pay for that $14 million of debt over time in student fees. Do they know? Is it clear in, like, you know, I just paid a tuition check for, I have a student at Boston University, right?
Yep.
I don't remember building debt being something that was broken out in her fees.
Yeah, I think many people would be surprised. I mean, what you have to take into context as well is we are provided a large subsidy from the Commonwealth to the tune of $50 million a year. That equates to $25,000 per full-time day undergraduate students. We choose to spend that state funding to cover personnel, but there's no reason, you know, there's all a compilation of expenditures and then various revenues that come in. So to say this certain pot of funds goes to cover debt, it isn't quite that clear cut, but there certainly is an impact of borrowing on student costs.
So is the report, the Campus Debt Reveal report, that says students pay $2,500 a year in fees for their university's building debt on average, is that number correct?
As also tried to, he tried to explain, was a portion of that is
Professor Emeritus Levy.
Portion of that is for auxiliary enterprises, things like dining and residence halls. Those are, in fact, paid by user fees because you basically don't want to charge others that aren't using it. The academic fee or academic capital expenses are for everybody, and everybody gets charged for that because it's a benefit to the individual.
So to be clear, in this $14 million, right, if a student's paying $2,500 in fees that going towards, and we're doing a little bit at Apple, but for argument's sake, what you're saying is, okay, but if it was to build a dorm, then only the people who are living there and eating there are paying that in their fees.
Yep.
If it was to build an academic building, all the students, whether I'm a science major or not, I'm paying in my fees for the Science Center, and I probably can't see what they are.
That's correct. And to let you know, most campuses have a debt policy. In our case, we have a cap of 5% of operations can go to debt service. The Commonwealth uses the same type of governor on spending. They have an 8% debt burden cap that they put on annual spending on capital. So there's a governor on spending. And in fact, by having a portion of it, this is the argument for the 25% match, having a portion of it have to come from the institutions, there's a better recognition of designing a building that meets needs and maybe not wants. You know, everybody wants everything, and this is a governor on that exercise.
So governor not being Baker in this case, governor being a cap, right?
Yes.
So what you're saying is that a public institution is going to have some kind of policy that says, of the money we spend every year, only X percent, 5, 8, if I recall Rich Levy saying 10% at Salem State University, some percentage of that can go to paying debt. And so we're not going to build things and we're not going to borrow things that are going to be more than that.
Correct.
Okay.
Because that would put too much of a burden on students and reduce flexibility over time.
So you are both, you know, clear-eyed and understandably chill in your role about this. This is, in fact, concerning. Yes or no?
Yes. I mean, anything that impacts the cost to students is concerning. And I was also pleased to have him bring up the Fair Share amendment that recently
passed. Question one that just passed.
We certainly see that as an avenue, depending on what the legislature and the new administration might do, to direct funding to the campuses to, in fact, be able to positively impact increases in student fees.
All right. I feel like we've got a sense of this now, and I think I hear you saying that question one might change this picture in the future.
We hope so. Thank you.
All right. Dale Hamill is Executive Vice President of the Division of Administration, Finance, and Information Technology at Framingham State. Have a good rest of the academic year.
Thank you.
So the November election over, but new work has started in earnest for Massachusetts Governor-elect Maura Healey as she prepares for the state's corner office. Will her transition into the governorship and Governor Baker's transition out of it be smooth? WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks joins us now from the newsroom. Anthony, welcome back.
Hey, good to be here, Tiziana.
So does it seem like the Healey transition is on track, Anthony?
Yeah, I think it seems like it is on track. She's following a route that's been followed by previous newly elected governors, including Charlie Baker 8 years ago. And she's pretty much following the same schedule. She set up a transition structure, which is made up of six teams that focus on six key policy areas, each staffed by people with particular expertise in those areas. So those areas include housing, transportation, climate readiness, jobs in the economy, youth and young adults, and then what they're calling safe and healthy communities, which is everything from healthcare to mental health and substance use and recovery to law enforcement resources for safe and healthy communities. So, yeah, that process is on track.
So, headlines so far from that big transition team, Anthony?
Well, I think the headline is that they're on track. I think that's one of them. Also, that hundreds of people from across Massachusetts have applied for jobs in the new administration. They applied through a website launched by Healey's transition team a few weeks ago. Lieutenant Governor-elect Kim Driscoll is chairing the transition effort, and I spoke to her about this, and she talked about this pool of applicants. She said it includes more than 750 people from across the state. Here's a bit of what she said.
the key to having a successful organization is building out a team that wants to do the work. So it's really encouraging to think that we have, you know, almost 1,000 individuals who said, hey, put me in, coach, right? I want to play.
And residents were also, through that web portal, they were able to offer suggestions for what the new administration should focus on. And Driscoll said the top issues are housing and affordability.
So that 700 number really strikes me, Anthony. You know, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu was just in here yesterday talking about her first year and that one of her challenges was hiring in that first year. Yeah. Is 700 a lot of people raising their hand and saying, put me in, coach?
I think it is, and it's a great question. And actually, before I came on air today, I wanted to go back and try to compare that number to how many people applied for the Baker administration and the Deval Patrick administrations before that. And I didn't come up with that number. But it does sound like a pretty big number. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, they obviously have a short list of people that they want to bring into the administration, and to be able to have a pool of applicants from all across the Commonwealth that is close to 1,000 people, as Kim Driscoll says, that sounds like a healthy interest in public service at the state level to me.
So as you noted, the last basis of comparison we have is when Governor Charlie Baker did his transition 8 years ago. I know you did go back and look. Any other interesting points of comparison that you would highlight?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the sense I get about the incoming Healey administration is it's going to be pretty steady as she goes, and there's going to be a lot of consistency from the Baker administration to the Healey administration. Yeah, so I looked back 8 years ago, Baker had set up the same idea, a bunch of transition teams. He focused on schools, jobs in the economy, health, community, like neighborhoods and that kind of stuff, and something that was sort of near and dear to his heart, better government. But with the exception of that sort of heading of better government, you know, schools, jobs in the economy, health in the community, very similar focus to what Maura Healey is doing right now. So I was struck by that. She's, you know, really using the same template. And I think there's going to be a remarkable amount of consistency in how the Commonwealth is governed when we transition from Baker to Healey.
Okay, so Anthony Brooks, sit tight. We will come back to you in a little bit, but I want to bring in a voice and have a conversation here with Michael Curry, who is the CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. He's on the line. He is co-chairing Governor-elect Healey's Health Committee Transition Team. Michael, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Glad to be back with you.
So this Health Committee, tell us what it's focused on.
Yeah, I think, as was said, it's a huge mandate and a credit to Governor-elect Healey and Lieutenant Governor Driscoll for convening these transition committees. I have flashbacks, and a good flashbacks, to 17 years ago when I served on Deval Patrick's transition team. At that time, the CEO of Blue Cross, which is where I worked at the time, Jim Hunt at the Mass League Community Health Centers, and Tom Glenn co-chaired the Health Committee. And that work was pretty intense, fielding interest and concerns and issues from community, and then policy experts, and then putting that into a package report for then Governor Patrick. I think that work is the same now, 17 years later.
And that's the That's the same Tom Glenn, I'm assuming, Michael, who's now doing transportation in this transition.
Exactly. And it's interesting that Tom and I are back again doing this work 17 years later. But I think it's phenomenal. Credit to them. They put together a phenomenal group of leaders in community advocacy and health policy and health equity in the health insurance space, the provider space, the hospital space. And over the course of the next several weeks, we'll think about all the critical issues that candidate Maura Healey, Attorney General Maura Healey, was lifting up as the critical issues, and then those that we bring to the conversation as well. And then we'll package that and provide that to the administration for their consideration. It is a phenomenal process. I am glad that Governor-elect Healey is doing this, because it says that she's already coming in willing to listen to community, listening to the various sectors, and being ambitious and aspirational about what we can do as a state.
So, Michael, I want to dig in on this a little bit, because when I heard that you were on this particular transition team, I immediately began thinking about all the conversations that we had here on Radio Boston with you, especially in the early days of the pandemic. Questions around health equity and outcomes and safety and whether we were making the right public health policies, et cetera. So you, Michael Curry, who as the head of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers went through that, what are the priorities that you're bringing to this transition team where you're thinking, here's what we have got to get right with great care, not so much for a particular governor-elect, but for this Commonwealth in this moment, given what you know?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to preempt the work that we'll do together or the focus that the Healey administration wants to put on this process. I will say, just to your question, what I bring a focus on. So I think, you know, there's some pillars to our system: affordability or cost, quality and access, right? Those are the key aspects of the system. Can we address the affordability issues that keep people from care? So they're choosing between paying their bills and a prescription drug or going to get a visit with their primary care provider. Can we deal with the access issues, particularly on the heels of COVID-19, where there's a workforce crisis? Many people are leaving the profession, are burnt out, are retiring, and now there's a deferred care crisis where people have not received the substance use disorder, the mental health, the physical, the health, the cancer screenings are down. How do we get people back into care? So I think there's a lot for us to be thinking about in those three: quality, cost, affordability. But then I add access, choice, I should say, and equity. How can we now center equity in everything we do as a Commonwealth? And I think that's what I'll bring to those conversations, that no matter what the conversation is, how are we doing it in a way that eliminates health disparities, that ensures that Black, brown, poor, immigrant, rural folks have the health care they need when they need it at the cost that they can afford.
So, Michael, will the public, you talked about the governor-elect, you feel good that you feel like the governor-elect is valuing community input. Will there be eyes in for the public to your process, to how the transition team is working? And when can the public expect to see whatever deliverable you're producing on your committee for this governor's transition?
Well, you know, when you're appointed to these roles, you smartly know to refer those questions to the campaign and the committee, that they have to figure those pieces out. Then my job is pretty narrow, which is to be a convener, a facilitator of the conversation, and then to work with a phenomenal group of young leaders that she's pulled together as her transition team, her staff, to really capture what we discuss and put that into a report. I'm confident knowing Maura Healey, that she'll make what is presented to her available for the public. And the website, and I want to just stress this, the HealeyDriscollTransition.com includes an opportunity for people to share their ideas. There's a button at the top of the screen so that you share your ideas, and whether it's health or housing or climate or the other areas, I think people should receive her invitation to share their concepts, their thoughts, their policy recommendations. That is how government should work. It should be participatory, and I think she's starting off the administration the right way.
We're talking about the transition between Governor-elect Maura Healey into the office as Governor Charlie Baker transitions out. Michael Curry is with us, President and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, who co-chairs the Health Transition Committee. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks is still with us from the newsroom. Anthony, I'm going to bring you in here. Do you have any additional questions for Michael Curry?
Oh, yeah. It's great to talk to you, Michael, and thanks for being here.
Same here.
I do have a question. Yeah, I'd love to get your perspective on this. The sense that I get looking at the names that Healey has brought on to these transition teams, and I think it's great that she brought you on, by the way, but to me it signals that Healey is assembling a pretty moderate administration. I mean, experienced, competent, but it seems like it includes lots of experienced insiders. And I'm thinking of names like Danielle Cerny, who's directing the transition. I'm thinking of names like Gina McCarthy, former EPA administrator, who served also under Republican governors. You mentioned Thomas Glynn, who's leading the Transportation Committee, an MBTA insider. So, sorry, that's a long run-up to the question. Fair to sort of assess this as a kind of, you know, very well qualified, experienced group of people, but moderate as well, in a kind of that will sort of represent a consistency from the Baker administration to the new administration.
Yeah, I mean, I've been impressed. Folks have been calling me, of course, because of their interest in serving the administration, and I redirect them to the campaign, of course. But when I look at the list across all the different areas, and I think about folks like Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, or Betty Francisco on the economic development and job side, or Manny Lopes, who was at East Boston Health Center, now at Blue Cross Blue Shield, Juan LaPera, who's been working around the health equity movement with many of us. She's put a team together that I think folks should have a sense of comfort that you have representation at the table that will be championing the things that you care about. If you care about access and affordability and cost, if you care about health equity and addressing COVID-19 and the flu season that we're coming into, you have really competent, qualified people there fighting. Teron Dorsey at Eastern Bank is another example. Elsie Tavares at Mass General Brigham. When I tell you it's a dream team of community folk, activists, and I think we have a lot of work to do. And then we need to reach out to communities that are not at the table, that are not named to this committee, to these committees, and we need to get their input as well. And I think this group is committed to that.
So, Michael Curry, before we let you go, I do want to ask you, is there any chance that your service on this transition team indicates you might be a cabinet secretary in this new government?
If I got a dime for every time I got that question, I would have a little bit of money right now. You know what? Reality is, I've been here before. Again, as I mentioned, I was on Deval Patrick's transition team as a staffer. I worked on Mayor Walsh's transition team. Mayor Belzotti in Brockton and Mayor Sullivan supported him once he became governor and worked with him and some of his work. So I've been here before. I think my role is as a health policy person, as a community health center person, to support their efforts to do this work of providing better health care in Massachusetts. That's the only role that I will serve in this process. But I'm honored that people think that I would be a candidate for any job in the public space.
All right. Michael Curry, CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the work.
Thank you.
So, Anthony Brooks, back to you now. Reactions to everything you just heard?
Well, really interesting. And I guess sort of what I'm really focused on going forward as we head toward the holidays is, you know, we're going to begin to hear about cabinet appointments. We should be hearing that. Again, I was looking back at the timing of the Baker administration 8 years ago, and as we rolled in toward the sort of Christmas holiday season, we began learning who was going to be serving on his cabinet. And so that will be really interesting to see. And again, sort of the question that I was getting at there with Michael Curry, my guess is that we're going to see some cabinet picks that are going to really represent a kind of consistency from the Baker administration to this new Healey administration. I may be wrong about that, but I'm getting that sense so far.
So we've got about 90 seconds. I do want to do a plus one, Anthony, because we've spoken with you so much here on the show about state Republican leadership, and we have seen real eruption, if not disruption, in the Mass GOP since the kind of washout in the election. Not clear yet whether the current head, Jim Lyons, is going to run again. What are you watching for and seeing there?
It's just a really interesting moment for the state GOP. It pretty much lost all across the board. It's got no Republican members of the congressional delegation. It faces a supermajority on Beacon Hill. And, it ran Jeff Deal for governor, who got trounced by Maura Healey by a 2-1 margin. So Jim Lyons' embrace of the sort of Donald Trump wing of the Republican Party hasn't worked out for the Republican Party in Massachusetts. So it does seem like it's time for a reckoning. And I'm wondering if that's going to happen. And I don't know the answer to that, because this isn't the first time that the state GOP has faced this moment of reckoning. So we'll see what happens. But there is clearly, this is happening in state Republican parties across the country that didn't do well in this last election. And people are beginning to say, hey, wait a minute, maybe we should be moving in a different direction. We'll see if that happens in Massachusetts as well.
In the implied different direction being less Trump, more local.
Yeah. Yeah. And in Massachusetts, it's like, you know, will the GOP go back to a sort of Charlie Baker type of Republican and run them, because they win and Trump-style Republicans don't win in Massachusetts.
All right, WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks, we are going to be talking to you about this more, I know, in the weeks ahead. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tachi and Andrea Perdomo-Hernandez. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. You are great listeners. Thanks for joining us. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.